This weekend, the Gay Softball World Series is happening here in Kansas City. And tonight, the guy who brought the whole deal to town is throwing out the first pitch at the Royals game for the first ever Pride Night at the K to be officially sponsored by the Royals. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to learn more about the Gay Softball World Series, what it means to host it here, and whether events like Pride Night at the K signal a growing sense of inclusion in men's sports or no. Scott Schweitzer is Executive Director of Gay Softball World Series 2019. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Gina. How are you?
Good. How are you? You're going to be throwing a pitch at the K tonight.
I am. I'm very excited. I've been practicing all week.
That's good. Tell me about the Gay Softball World Series. What's the significance and magnitude of this?
So the Gay Softball World Series this year is held in Kansas City. It's the 43rd annual series. It goes from city to city each year. Last year it was in Tampa, Florida, and next year it'll be in Columbus. Kansas City has a rich history of gay softball in Kansas City. This is our 42nd annual season. We broke a record for the most teams in the World Series this year at 207 teams, so we were really happy.
200-plus teams from Kansas City?
200 teams throughout the United States and Canada.
That makes more sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
But why do you think Kansas City does have this rich history, 42 years?
I think the rich history started, you know, it was a way that people could come out and be who they are on a field and find themselves a safe place together and play together without being afraid of where they're at and being around their friends and people that are other people that are like them.
How many gay softball players are in town for this thing?
So we have over 5,000 players and spectators in town. This thing will put in about a $10 million economic impact into Kansas City. We're really happy about that.
And there are, what, 6,000 teams in the whole league?
There's 6,000 teams probably throughout NAGA, and that's, again, through the United States and Canada. There's 48 member cities, and NAGA stands for North American Gay Amateur Athletic Association.
So Rick Levitt is actually one of the original founders of the Gay Softball League that's having this World Series. He lives in Kansas City now, but helped start the whole thing when he lived in Florida. Is that right, Rick?
Almost.
Almost.
Yeah, not so much NAGA, but for the state of Florida, I did help. I was one of the founding members to help the very first softball team in the state of Florida, as well as the first softball league, Gay Softball League, in the state of Florida. That was 25 years ago, so well after Kansas City.
What inspired you to start a gay softball team and league in Florida? What made that seem important to you?
Actually, what happened was I was at a meeting about a month or two before getting some people together regarding there's actually another competitive venue called Gay Games, and that's held throughout the world. And again, it's at a different city across the world. I went there to talk about racquetball, but had a friend who ended up being a friend stood up and talked about softball. So we talked about softball, and then around 1992-93, we got together and helped form, and like Scott said, a space for those who want to compete in this sport.
So tell me more about that. What's your personal relationship been with team sports as a gay man?
The beginning of it had a lot more meaning because in the early 90s when HIV and AIDS was prevalent, a lot of the people that joined had they'd been deemed 100% disabled because there was no cure. So they had not much to look forward to.
Deemed 100% disabled by?
By work. So they couldn't go back to work. So they had not much to look forward to. And so when we created this league, not only was it for people who in junior high and high school that were picked on because they were bullied or they were called sissies or they were picked last, not only giving them a place to play, but also these other folks who needed something to do and take their mind off what was really happening to them.
But what about you?
I've been playing ball since I was five. My dad was Little League president, so I had no choice. I had to play. And I did this for complete fun. I didn't really mean it to be meaningful. I meant to have a lot of fun and realized later on I meant a lot more to other people.
Tell me some of those stories.
Two of them that always ring a bell. I had one player's name is Steve Brooks, and he was diagnosed with AIDS, and he was a very difficult person. But of course, I coached him. He was getting worse. It got to the point where he could not. He was visually impaired. He was blind, and he came to me and said he still wanted to play. And I told him, Steve, I can't do this. And he said, Rick, if anybody can coach this, you can. And so I realized in the lowest divisions, most of the lower teams have pitchers that are hoping to get the ball across the plate. They're not fancy. They're not doing anything crazy. They're just pitching a ball. And so I figured it was like a dance step. So 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And then on 3, I would tell him to swing. So we practiced this, and he hit maybe 1 or 2 out of 10. But still, it's not bad for a visually impaired person. He could see shadows, but he wasn't completely blind. The commissioner of the league, who was also positive, heard about this and told me that he wouldn't allow it. And I told him, you tell Steve, because I'm not going to. And then he asked what my ideas were. So the only addition is we changed the white ball to a fluorescent yellow. And so if, when Steve got up to bat, I would be on the other side of the plate. If he happened to hit the ball and make it in fair play, he would hear my voice and follow it, and I'd run with him to first base.
Wow.
And then we get a courtesy runner.
What was that like for you to – people talk with, when someone's going through something, there's this common wisdom of you just walk with them through it. You ran with this man through this stage of HIV and right. Its progress in his body.
I didn't think anything of it. I was just trying to make him happy, and plus I was having fun. It was not for any other reason, just – I knew he probably didn't have much longer, so I wanted him to enjoy what he had.
Scott, what are your earliest memories of being involved in sports and what gay softball in particular has meant to you?
So my memories of sports, it was probably in my childhood. I'm the youngest of four boys, very sports-oriented family, grew up going to Arrowhead and Kauffman Stadium, and I was lucky enough to have a great support system after I came out that would actually come out to my games. Like even this year, I looked up in the stands at one game and I had 11 of my nieces and nephews watching me play, and my brothers and sister-in-laws and parents. And, they even came out to work one of the hospitality tables and help us. My mom and her bunco group helped us stuff player bags for this tournament. But being where it is now, I think, learning what I learned in sports about just the teamwork and respecting your competition and respecting your teammates and just being a good sportsman on the field really, really brings teams together. It brings leagues together, and it's shown clearly in Kansas City. It's brought our community together as well.
Is it different to play sports in a setting where your sexual orientation is such a non-issue, like it's a given?
I think if you're playing sports and you can't be exactly who you are, you're not going to perform at 100%. You're always worried about what other people might think about you or like Rick said, how you throw the ball or something like that. So, this gay league was created so that we didn't have to worry about that we could just come out. And a lot of this is educational as well. We now have 7 divisions, A, B, C, D, and E. Pretty much your rec league all the way up to pretty competitive. And that being said, you could grow and you could grow up and you could go from division to division as you get better. And, if you go up to a B and feel like that's not for you, then you could come right back down to C. And then we also have our masters, which is 50 and older. So it's just been great to watch all of this happen.
Rick, for you, as someone who has been part of the league for, 25 years, you said?
Yeah, it's been around for 25 years. I left in 2001, so I was with them for about 10, 12 years.
How have things changed since those days? I mean, in the last 25 years, how have things changed?
Well, the Tampa League has gotten a lot bigger. Also, since the Tampa League was formed, the Tampa folks also helped Orlando form their first league. They helped Fort Lauderdale form their first league. So that's how they helped the state. In itself, I believe there's also another league in St. Pete, so there's, which is real close to Tampa. But when I left, there were 17 teams. When I started, obviously, there was one, then four. So it's, but it's much more than 17 now.
Do you see that same kind of growth here in Kansas City?
Absolutely, yeah.
What do you think is driving that?
And I think, like Scott says, the acceptance, the camaraderie, and with not just you know, people who are gay, but also who are gay friendly, who are accepting. That's been instrumental, I know, in Tampa, because if it wasn't for a lot of my, you know, fellow coworkers who weren't gay, that was supporting, it wouldn't be as big as it is either.
And Scott, you also mentioned seeing your nieces and nephews out in the stands, that it's not the idea behind this. It does not sound like the idea is that it's gay softball players and gay spectators, that it's the spectators, that the community is invited.
Absolutely. The community is invited. And, you know, it's also us going out in the community. A lot of these teams aren't limiting themselves to these gay leagues anymore. We'll go out and play in a you know, in a straight tournament, and they, you know, they, we kind of show up in our pink uniforms or whatever that, you know, we all match, and they kind of look at us and think, who are these guys? And then all of a sudden our teams are waxing the floor with these, with in the straight leagues as well.
So I guess, Rick, are you going to the K tonight for Pride Night with the Royals?
I'm hoping so. I got to talk to my husband. We're both co-sponsoring the tournament. We own
a little busy right now.
Yeah, we own Midcoast Modern and Soap Bar, and we're going to be at an event tomorrow night, selling some of our stuff at one of the events.
So, Scott, we haven't talked a lot about the fact that you are throwing the first pitch at the K tonight. You are so excited, but what does that mean to you as far as visibility, acceptance, all of those things?
This is incredible for us tonight. This is our fifth year doing Out with the Royals Pride Night. And, you know, the Royals have been...
So I just want to jump in and say there have been nights at the K that are sponsored by outside groups before, and then tonight is the first official Pride Night.
Correct. It was kind of a grassroots effort with myself and about four of my friends. And, you know, each year it got bigger and bigger, you know. At the beginning, we had buses that left from each bar, and they had beer on the bus, and you could go out to the tailgate and have a great barbecue buffet, and then go into the game. And we talked to the Royals every single year that we did this, so much so that they were given $5 from each ticket to the AIDS Service Foundation in Kansas City. And then this year, you know, a friend of ours, Billy Bean, who is the MLB Director of Diversity and Inclusion in New York City, would come in and help us. And he said, you know, this is a marriage with your local MLB team. You kind of have to date before you get married. And I guess we both said I do this year. they came on big time and said, we want to have this full Pride Night for you. And they gave us 2,000 tickets. And again, $5 from each ticket sold goes to AIDS Service Foundation. And we just found out on Monday that we sold out on those 2,000 seats. So we're over the moon on that.
And most, if not all, MLB teams are already doing this throughout the country.
Correct. I believe there's a couple teams in the MLB that are not doing it. I kind of joke and think that the Royals saw St. Louis doing it and said, well, we better get on this
pretty quick.
Yeah,
because that was last year.
Yes, it was.
So, I mean, I'm curious what you think an event like that means, seeing it sponsored by the Royals, to aspiring athletes out there in the crowd or just watching the game from home on TV. What would it have been like if you just imagine yourself as like a preteen, Rick, seeing the Royals sponsoring?
Well, I think it would be a great opportunity for those who are questioning themselves, maybe a teenager that might be, whether they're gay or not, or questioning their sexuality. They can see that. There's really no difference. So I think it'd be a great opportunity for them to see, you know, that we're accepted and everything's really the same.
Do you guys think that the scale of the Gay Softball World Series coinciding with Pride Night at the K, does all of that signal to you a larger change when it comes to inclusion in team sports, or do we still have a long way to go?
I still think we have a long way to go on it. I mean, hopefully, I think the goal is one day that an athlete comes out and it's not a big deal. I mean, it's right now it's great to see, and it encourages younger athletes and younger people just to say that, you know, it's okay to be who you are. I mean, the suicide rate of LGBTQ plus youth is, it needs to be much lower than it is, and having the support from everybody else gives those kids support to be who they are.
Scott Switzer, Executive Director of the Gay Softball World Series 2019. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Gina.
And Rick Levitt, founder of the league in Florida. Thank you.
Thank you.
The championship game is this Saturday, and you can get information at cometoplay.org. Up next, the future of First Fridays. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're talking about First Fridays in the Crossroads. You may have heard things will be different this Friday, and we're going to start by getting some clarity on exactly what will be different and why before turning our attention to some of the larger tensions around the event, what it should be, and maybe even who it's for. Let's start by getting some facts from the chair of First Fridays with us from the Crossroads Community Association, Jeff Owens. Good morning. It's nice to see you.
Hi, good morning.
So what will and won't be different from what people have come to expect this First Friday in the Crossroads?
Well, this First Friday is going to be special for sure because we lost our liability insurance on our festival permit. And so we had to sort of shut down all the festival areas. So within our festival area, there will be no food trucks and no vendors and no street performers. But all the other brick and mortar shops will be open, all the galleries will be open, restaurants will be open. So there'll be plenty fun things to do, but it will have a big-time different feel.
And I'm guessing none of those street closures to make certain areas pedestrian-oriented? Or will that still be going on?
Yeah, so, you know, people will be able to walk around on the sidewalks and whatnot. We won't have any road closed, so everybody will have to stay on the sidewalks this time. But, yeah, be a lot of stuff to do.
So you mentioned that this is driven by an insurance issue. The policy that used to cover all those things, you lost that insurance. This happened after a fatal shooting at last month's event. Was that why you lost the coverage, or was the timing more?
No, that's exactly why we lost the coverage. You know, prior to that, we've almost hardly anything happen. Over a million people, million and a half people has come to First Friday over the last 10 years. And it's just been this incredible thing, you know, where just tons of people, all different kinds of people, all with smiles on their faces. So this is just a huge shocker. And, you know, typical insurance, you only give it to you when you don't need it.
So are you trying to find new insurance so you can resume First Friday and the Crossroads as Kansas City has come to know it in recent years? Or is some of this change maybe going to last?
Yes, we are going to change a few things. We're obviously working really hard to try to find new insurance. The insurance we had before was really affordable for us, and it was able to cover these giant crowds, you know, that we had 20 to 30,000 people. So we're trying to obviously get new insurance. We've got a bunch of cool agents looking for it. And on top of that, you know, just the whole safety factor, you know, we're trying to feed that into the equation and, you know, try to tighten up our ship a little bit, if you will.
What would that look like?
So, you know, one of the things we want to do is close sooner. You know, the galleries most all the time were open from 6 to 9, and now we want to close, you know, at 9, try to get everything to close at 9, and maybe everything gone by 10. Which would be a couple hours sooner than we have been doing. You know, we have a lot of things going on down there that we don't have big footprints to do, like the food trucks area. They're so popular and we have so many people there. It's a pretty massive crowd. So I don't know. We're just going to kind of look at that and see if there's some way we can thin that down a little bit, you know. So there's some things that are going to take some real work to figure out, but you know, we're going to try to calm it down a little bit.
I understand that there was a big meeting last week, like a town hall type thing, where it became clear that not everyone wants the same thing going forward.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We had quite a few people from the community come in and weigh in on what they thought, the things they loved about First Friday and some of the things they didn't like about First Friday.
What kinds of stuff did you hear?
Just, you know, all over the board. They thought the crowds were too big on 18th Street, where it was hard to get from East Crossroads to West Crossroads, you know, just to get by the crowd at food trucks. They didn't, some people didn't like the late night crowds that were there, weren't really there looking at art. They were there, you know, more of a party mode. You know, some folks didn't like some activities that were really loud, you know, like super loud music or something like that. And then, you know, there's also people living down in Crossroads. Quite a few people live down there, so they didn't necessarily like the late nights. Of course, everybody loved the things that we all love about First Friday, you know, just the cool family atmosphere, you know, from the 6 to 9 time period. But, you know, the vendors, there's a lot of vendors set up on all the sidewalks. It makes it hard for some of the folks that live there just to get home, you know, have to walk around the vendors. There's a lot of things that potentially can be a little bit aggravating, but, you know, it's only one day a month. So, you know, hopefully we'll get around some of those things. But yeah. Overall, though, it was a real cross-section. And there also, some people didn't like road closures. It could be a little inconvenient for a few folks. But overall, it was just kind of a the main things that people came up with, you know, was just one of the big things was have it alcohol-free.
How did that go over with the crowd that had gathered? Did most people support that idea?
Yeah, that's where that came from.
Because there used to be such a rallying cry behind getting that permit for there to be alcohol. There was a moment, you know, not in the not too distant past.
Yeah, you know, we had a beer garden in the Crossroads for a little while, and they were on private property and they lost that spot. So they came to us and they were going to try to find another private spot, and they came to us to see if we would kind of incorporate it a little bit in our thing. So we did that. But, you know, the goal is to try to make it as less hectic as possible. And just the fact that we would promote it as an alcohol-free event kind of sets the tone, you know, to try to help everybody, you know, in that direction.
Well, hang on just a moment with me. Jeff Owen. Steve Paul is with us now. He was the editor of the arts and entertainment section in the Kansas City Star for a long time. He's kind of a man about town in the art world, and he's seen First Fridays evolve over time. Steve, I remember, and I think you do too, what this event was like before its current conception. First Fridays used to be these kind of little under the radar parties.
Mm. Yeah. Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me. Yeah. I mean, and I'm not one to argue that we should go back to those days, that golden era
yeah.
of the Crossroads when everything was kind of small and unique and elite and all that. But it was a much smaller community. And I think, you know, we've gotten to the point of careful what you wish for in a number of different ways, in the sense that, one, that community has grown much bigger, and the neighborhood has grown much bigger, and the attraction of this sort of street party has become something way beyond what the initial sort of momentum for, you know, an art gallery walk.
Was that original momentum? Can you talk about how First Friday started?
Yeah, I mean, that neighborhood at the time was being reborn at the hands of art dealers and artists who had opened galleries. And
we're not talking about tons of art galleries.
No, a handful of galleries and landlords who were art friendly, and artists who had moved into cheap studio space. And, you know, Jeff knows, Jeff was obviously there. But the scene was really much more of a closed community, in the sense that people who were really interested in art would come down and travel, walk from one gallery to the other, see what artists were up to. You know, a little wine was served in the galleries, that kind of thing. But it wasn't like an open big thing. You saw people you knew, you saw them every month, and it was nice.
Can you identify a moment where like a switch was flipped? Or was it really super gradual?
Well, it was kind of gradual. And I think, again, Jeff might have the factual basis for this, but in the that was, so you know, starting in the 90s and then into the 2000s, I'd say, you know, 15 years ago, maybe 10, 12 years ago, as more development was happening in the Crossroads, more people were coming downtown, the streetcar was under construction, just all this lively scene had happened. And this is exactly what Kansas City wants, is a lively street life. And so that's what First Friday became, with this lively street scene that everybody who wants a vibrant city wants to see and wants to have. And so this, you know, nice art-oriented community has to deal with the fact that they're, it's much bigger than that, and it became much bigger than that. And art really took a second chair to the event. Now, one thing that's happening that's kind of interesting is that a lot of the galleries in the neighborhood are doing kind of like soft openings on Thursday nights. So they know that their patrons, the people who really want to look at art, are not that comfortable coming down on Friday. You can't find a place to park, blah, blah, blah. And the Thursday night openings are becoming a little bit more common in the galleries and in the art world down there. And then Friday is a party, and a party that's gotten maybe a little out of hand, but I don't think so.
So when we talk about that it's gotten bigger than just this mm-hmm. little art crowd, mm-hmm. I mean, that can mean a lot of different things, mm-hmm. and people's discomfort could come from a lot of different places. Do you have thoughts about where people's discomfort with what's happening on Friday, especially as the night gets later, where that's coming from?
Well, Jeff mentioned that, although there are a couple things. You know, there are many more bars and restaurants, and so to say, you know, an alcohol-free event is a little disingenuous, in the sense that, you know, people can hang out on the patios of bars and restaurants and drink and all that. Maybe you can't walk around with a beer in your hand. You know, and that's to...
But drunkenness.
Yeah. You know, here's one of the things that's going... You know, the drunken folks on electric scooters, yeah, that can be a problem. The crowded sidewalks with the tchotchke vendors and that sort of thing, I can see the frustrations there. You know, if you're really interested in art, you know, can you muscle your way through a crowd to get inside a gallery? All that stuff. I can see the frustrations there, the noise maybe. You know, I'm a little skeptical about what really can be done to change and what a real effect that have. I sympathize with the food vendors, and I have a question, if I could, of Jeff, because
yeah.
One thing I don't quite understand is, why can the vendors just set up on their own, under their own license, somewhere on the edge of,
yes,
or and can't that happen without your insurance policy?
Absolutely.
Yeah, good. Well, that's what I wanted to hear. I mean, I think, you know, I sympathize with them, because they're business people who have come to rely on that kind of major revenue stream. And I'd hope that some solution can maybe be found, that they can operate in certain ways.
On that note, mm-hmm. I want to bring someone else in on this conversation, a street performer, because we've talked about that mm-hmm. there will not be food vendors officially associated with First Fridays in a couple days, but also there won't be street performances officially associated with First Fridays in a couple of days. A.Y. Young is with us by phone because he's on the road. He's on tour. He's headed to New York right now. And A.Y. is he's a musician. He's been on this show before. And last time I was at a First Friday, he was out singing on the street, playing beats, and getting random people walking by to learn some choreography. He had people dancing in unison. It was super fun. His name is A.Y., as I mentioned. A.Y., good morning.
Good morning. How you guys doing?
Pretty good. So no street performers, that affects you.
Yeah, that affects. So first of all, I wanted to say, hi, guys. Nice meeting you. It's an honor. I, you know, after I got off the X Factor TV show in 2012, I started doing renewable energy powered concerts with that, which is wind and solar stored in batteries, which is called the Battery Tour. And the Country Club Plaza and the Euro Crossroads, sir, was my main venue and source of income to bring people together around the world and make this happen as I tour. So I wanted to say it's an honor to talk to you, first off.
And so how do you see the possibility of not being able to do street performance affecting you? And then I'm also curious about your sense of the role that street performance has in what this event, First Fridays in the Crossroads, has become.
Yeah, in short, you know, street performing, I think in any city, and maybe you guys will agree with me on this, it's a vital heartbeat and culture. It really, really can exemplify culture of a city. I think it can really boost tourism. It can really stimulate the local economy, right? So, you know, a city that doesn't have street performers or street performances, I think it's detrimental to a city's growth. And so, you know, in my meetings, when I'm in city council, or when we're at the environmental department of, you know, Kansas City, or when we're working with these world leaders, even, you know, just with Al Gore recently, music, arts, entertainment, it's a heartbeat of a city. And I think it's essential. And if you take that away from First Fridays, which is really the only option as a street performer in Kansas City anymore, you know, the Plaza, it gets very, really leery. You know, me personally, it's taking away my life because this is how I make a living, right? So to give you a short, like, story of what I do is, like, through these street performances that I do powered with renewable energy, I also raise money to send people solar-powered batteries around the world that don't have access to electricity. So when you guys stop me from being able to do the battery tour at First Fridays, stopping me from bringing people together, that's stopping us from being able to provide a platform, because a lot of Kansas City doesn't have a lot of platforms for artists. So the Battery Tour also, you know, has full sound and equipment for, and we host artists, right, to be able to perform and do their original music. So you're taking that platform away, and then you're also, also stopping us from getting the world plugged in. So it's making my life really hard. It's one of the main reasons why I'm heading to New York now, because New York is a place where street performing is accepted.
So, I mean, do I understand you correctly saying First Fridays in Kansas City, that's one of the few outlets for street performers here?
Yeah, First Fridays is one of the only outlets, you know, and one of my favorite ones. Like, since 2012, I've been doing First Fridays when it was really not that many people out there, and now it's incredible, right? But you really only have a couple of options in Kansas City where you have a density of people where you can actually make a profit street performing. You know, you can collect those dollars and cents. And First Friday has not only become probably one of the most financially beneficial places, but it's one of the only places you can go, right? So you have left no option for us street performers if this goes through, or if we can't make some changes or compromises here. You know, there are no options for us. I'm a full-time performer, which there's not many of those, you know, in the Midwest alone, and definitely in Kansas City.
Hey, A.Y., I want to jump in because I have one more question for you, and then I'll let you get back to the road. What do you think about the idea of, I mean, in this conversation, there's a little bit of a sense of there's the art, which is in galleries, and then these street performances are something other than art. What do you feel about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, More elaborate. Ask that question again. So the street performance, as far as the music.
Do you think
like
of
that,
I mean, do you think of the art as being strictly what's happening in the galleries, or is the art partly what's happening on the street?
I think it's both. I think it's what's happening on the street. I think it's the galleries. I think art is art, and there's different mediums of art. And I think it's all about bringing people together in general, or people experiencing this culture, right? This incredible culture that has been established through First Fridays. And I think they're both, it's all part of the First Friday experience, experiencing music, experiencing art, experiencing good food, right? Experiencing family. I think it's all connected.
Well, AY, thank you so much and good luck in New York.
Thank you.
Jeff Owens of the Crossroads Community Association, what do you think about what we just heard from AY representing, I'm guessing, you know, a feeling shared by other street performers?
Yeah, I mean, actually, I agree with everything he said. And, you know, from our point of view, we're not restricting street performers. We might be a little leery of super amplified music potentially, but not street performers. We have we've always embraced them inside some of our galleries and on the street. So that's just one of the things that we're hoping to get back, you know, going again if we have
as
our
you
insurance
pursue that
in place.
Insurance, yep. Yeah. Call 816-235-2888 to join this conversation about the future of First Fridays. What direction do you hope to see for what's become a big festival celebrating art and fun in the Crossroads every month? Should the fatal shooting at last month's event change anything going forward, or is the change you do or don't want to see unrelated? 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. We're talking about First Fridays and the Crossroads. The big event has lost its festival license and liability coverage, which means no food vendors, no street performers, no street closures a couple of evenings from now. And that change might be temporary, but a lot is up in the air. We've been chatting about that with Jeff Owens of the Crossroads Community Association. He's the chair of First Fridays. We've also been hearing from a longtime chronicler of the arts in town, Steve Paul. And we heard earlier from a musician named AY who's done a lot of street performances at First Fridays. He wants that aspect of the event to be maintained going forward, obviously. But now let's hear from a visual artist who's shown and sold work at First Fridays for many years, Lisa Lala. Hello.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me.
So you are a painter represented by the Blue Gallery. That's been the case at least since I first saw your work in the early 2000s.
Yes. They have represented my work for a long time now, and they've been down there for 19 years. I've been going down to First Friday before even that, so I saw it in the early time, like Steve was discussing, about how the galleries were full, but the streets were not in the beginning.
What have First Fridays meant to you as an artist whose work has presumably gotten lots of exposure through First Friday?
Oh, absolutely. First Fridays have been so much fun. And I think probably about a decade ago, we switched my openings to Thursday nights. That was really the opening night then. So we would do invitation with food and drinks and fill the gallery on Thursday night with everyone there to hear the artist talk and see the work. And then I would come back then on Friday and just be available for people who wanted to ask me questions. And what I loved about what then that middle iteration of First Friday offered was that people who had never seen my work but knew me felt comfortable to come down on First Friday. So I'd see my neighbors and friends and coworkers and all these people who had never been to an art gallery before were not intimidated by First Friday. They were coming down with the masses. They were stopping in to say hello. And so I was selling work both nights. It's a wonderful thing. But then now we've kind of moved on to this iteration of like the third generation of First Friday, which is it's so mobbed that, you know, I'll have my opening on a Thursday, but then on Friday I'll be there and I'll have people say hello. But there's just a lot of people that are just kind of really filing through. And definitely when you get later into the night, you know, sort of drunk and bumbling. So it definitely has, it's interesting how it's changed. But then you get all the extra, like what's on the street with the street performers and all the energy, and it's very electric. So First Friday's definitely evolved.
What do you hear from other artists when you talk about First Fridays, and what was sort of most beneficial? Which iteration, you know, as you've put it, has been best for artists?
Well, I was just speaking with another artist before I came in, and we were chatting about it. And we were really discussing how the middle iteration was maybe like the golden iteration for artists, because you were both getting all of the collectors and art lovers and that regular group, but you're also bringing in extra friends and family and neighbors who were coming down to see the work. She mentioned that just the other day she had an opening. She was there on a Friday. She said the entire evening, no one asked her about her work. She said it was just people talking to each other, and that was disappointing.
So when you talk about the future of First Fridays, you know, what's the word on the street for people with that kind of skin in the game?
Right. Well, I think that there's still, it's still a wonderful being down there in the crossroads, showing in the crossroads, whether you're I think Thursday openings are definitely fabulous now. And Friday is just kind of a mixed bag of what you get as an artist, depending on what gallery you're at and how heavy the traffic is and if it's maybe too heavy.
You know, Jeff, the businesses other than galleries in the crossroads are also affected by First Fridays. I used to work at a business that really relied on First Fridays to bring in money a long time ago. They kind of made up for a lack of foot traffic that was characterized the crossroads the rest of the month at that time. But the crossroads has changed the rest of the month, too. I could honestly see First Friday helping businesses, but I could see it hurting businesses, too, just in the form of crowds keeping people away from the door, or yeah, just people wanting to hit a more slow-paced location. What have you heard from business owners? Did they come to that big meeting and weigh in?
Yeah, actually, they've been weighing in for a while, not just the meeting. And it's all over the board. You know, we have businesses that have a lot of sales and a lot of it's a really good night for them, and then others that their customers can't find a place to park. You know, it's just a bad night for them. So it's all over the board, and it just depends on what you're doing and what's going on.
I also wonder about whether safety was a concern for business owners and their customers before the shooting in August, or if that's a new concern based on that incident.
Yeah. So, just go back to Crossroads and its growth, through the 2000, it was, 6 to 10,000 people probably on the really busy summer nights. And then about two, three years ago, it blew up to about 20 to 30,000 people. So it was, I remember it perfectly being out there. And that brought up a whole other level of safety. The whole safety factor in today's world is a huge subject in its own, and we've been working really hard in that regard. And in the last 6 months, there's been a lot more younger crowd in the evening that's definitely there to party more, and so that's been a tricky thing for us to work around.
I want to bring in a caller. We've got someone on the line who has put together an event where he is inviting people to discuss what they want from their art community in Kansas City. And it sounds like moving First Fridays East is on his agenda. Anson, good morning.
Hi. I'm just calling to let everyone know that Charlotte Street Foundation is putting on an event this next First Friday at 40th and Troost at the Black Box Theater on Troost. It's for people to just say things they would like to see from the art community and how to organize it.
So what are your thoughts about what you've been hearing in this conversation so far? It sounds like you're also pushing for looking sort of beyond the core of the crossroads and moving east.
Yeah, I moved to Kansas City in 2010, and and I actually ran a small little gallery in that area for a little bit on Grand, and it was much smaller then and has really ballooned, which is good in some ways, but I think for the art community, it's not necessarily driving sales in the galleries.
Okay, so Anson, Anson has just weighed in with this idea about moving east, and Steve...
I was a little unclear whether he was talking about First Friday per se or larger art community.
Anson, can you respond to that?
Yeah, so the First Friday's Moving East event is just more for general wants in the community, just ideas and how to promote art in Kansas City. Mm-hmm.
Steve, what are your thoughts? I mean, people, the idea of the crossroads needing to move east, and that has been around for a while.
Well, even at first, when First Friday first began, I was reminded that there were galleries at 45th and State Line that were open on Friday nights. I mean, it was geographically, it was kind of all over the place. 18th and Vine, I mean, during First Fridays now, 18th and Vine participate. So there is some geographic movement. West Bottoms galleries and other locations. It's becoming more. It's not just a crossroads thing anyway. And in some ways, never really has been. It just this is the kind of the.
There's this crossover between the art event and the neighborhood
event.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so, but one thing to remind, and Anton might be getting at this, is that what he's talking about is an artist community, and what is that community? We must remember that First Friday began as a commercial activity. I mean, those kinds of events are commercial. It's a business association participating with artists and galleries, and galleries are businesses too. But so there's a difference between a business-spawned event and an artist-spawned event, and sometimes those visions clash. And
there's a difference between both of those things and a city event, which is what I think how people feel about it, is that this is Kansas City's First Friday.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's no question about it.
Lisa, if you got to just wave a magic wand and make First Friday what you would like it to be, what would you do?
Okay, well, that's a good question. And one of the things I was thinking about when we had AY call in was about like the Key West Sunset Celebration, and think about how cool that is. And it's happening at sunset, but there's a lot of street performers.
And it's every day.
And it's every day. We're just once a month, right? But the idea, it really made me think about how fabulous those street performers really are, but also how that's also something that's happening earlier in the day, right? So... I feel really comfortable with the event being earlier or just more in the 6 to 9 time zone, where all that magic can happen and all that community and bonding. But then maybe after 9 o'clock, you know, getting people into restaurants and into their next place. It used to be when you went to First Fridays, everyone was figuring out what restaurant they were all going to at the end. Like, hey, we're going here. We already have a table reserved. We're going there. If people
at
could
the
go...
end.
You know, at the end, if they're going more indoors to carry on their party, but not in a way, unfortunately, with today's climate of the violence and the crowds, like, I think you just have to take that into account. Hopefully this isn't a problem in the future, but right now it has to be taken into situation, especially the openly drunkenness, which is happening earlier, like kind of like remolding that a little bit. But yeah, I'd still have street performers and I have a lot of people coming down enjoying it.
I want to jump in because we have just the tiniest bit of time. And Jeff, we are getting some questions to clarify what the alcohol and what the alcohol plan would do for this event.
Yeah, so it was just to set a precedent. You know, right now nobody says about the event being alcohol or non-alcohol, and it just sets a tone, because I agree with Steve, there's plenty places that you can get a drink, but you know, just discourage open carry and set a tone
more than solve some bigger violence problem in the city.
Yep.
Our time is up. You can keep talking about First Fridays and the Crossroads, what you hope or fear for the future of those events on Twitter. We'd love to hear what you have to say at KCURCST. Steve Paul, great seeing you today.
Thanks.
Lisa Lala, artist represented by the Blue Gallery, thank you.
Thank you.
And Jeff Owens of the Crossroads Community Association, chair of First Fridays. Obviously, we will be following up on this. But good luck on Friday.
Thank you.
You can catch anything you missed at kcur.org/Central Standard. That's where we archive all our shows. Earlier in the hour, we talked about the Gay Softball World Series happening in Kansas City right now. Tomorrow, Hallmark's got some new card collections recognizing the diversity of card givers and receivers. More on that tomorrow. Our producers are Melody Rowell, Ann Kniggendorf, Aviva Okeson-Haberman, and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.